Welcome in, everybody. A big night here at Dominican University of California, right here on Penguin Radio. Dr. Anthony Fauci, part of the Institute for Leadership Studies series, June 25th, 2024.
Representing By the Bay Health is Skelly Wingard, Chief Executive Officer. Skelly began her career with a master's degree in nursing, working directly with patients, and gradually progressed into administration and management with more than 10 years of executive leadership experience. And to introduce our distinguished speakers, please join me in welcoming Skelly.
Good evening. Thank you for that intro, Dr. Klebanoff. I am honored to introduce our speakers for this evening. Dr. Anthony Fauci served as director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH from 1984 to 2022. He guided our nation through the COVID pandemic, one of the most terrifying periods in modern American history. He also played a major role in other global epidemics. His crucial leadership in researching HIV and bringing AIDS into a sympathetic public view, as well as navigating the Ebola, SARS, West Nile, and anthrax crises, solidifies Dr. Fauci's status as an American hero. Tonight, we celebrate the release of Dr. Fauci's memoir, On Call, which reaches back to his boyhood in Brooklyn, New York, and recounts his decades of caring for critically ill patients and advising seven presidents. On Call is an inspiration to all who admire Dr. Fauci as the embodiment of a true public servant known for speaking truth to power with dignity and results. Dr. Fauci is currently a distinguished university professor at Georgetown University. He has received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the National Medal of Science, and the Mary Woodard Lasker Award for Public Service. Additionally, he has been awarded 62 honorary doctoral degrees. Joining Dr. Fauci in conversation tonight is Barbara Boxer. Barbara Boxer served as California's senator from 1993 to 2017. She previously served in the U.S. House of Representatives for five terms after serving as Marin County's supervisor for 6 years. Senator Boxer is known as a fierce fighter for California and its people. She is also known as a consistent advocate for women, children, families, workers, the environment, and equal rights for all. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Fauci and Senator Barbara Boxer to our stage.
So what did you learn from your parents that has stayed with you all your life, if you had to boil it down?
Yeah. Well, Barbara, as you mentioned, my father was a pharmacist in Brooklyn, which was a working class neighborhood, the Bensonhurst section of Brooklyn. And this was the 1940s and 50s. And I was, you know, 7, 8 years old working in the pharmacy. But unlike the CVSs and the Walgreens now, the neighborhood pharmacy was, as Barbara said, was kind of like the hub of the neighborhood, where you would be the psychiatrist of the neighborhood, the marriage counselor, the advising parents whose children are delinquent, as well as providing medications they could prescribe by doctors. And when I said my father was generous to a fault, he had no material aspirations. He just wanted to serve the neighborhood. And often when people were not doing well financially, that they couldn't pay for the prescription, so he would put it on a bill, and often they wouldn't pay the bill because they just didn't have the money, which kind of shook my sister and I, but like, Dad, you know, we've got to get some money here. But what I learned when I realized what he was doing, that he was devoted to the service to the community in his own way as being Doc Fauci. They called him Doc. That's what they call a pharmacist then. And the reason that had an impact on me is that I was seeing that when I was 7, 8, 9 years old, and I would be delivering prescriptions on my Schwinn bike going up and down the neighborhood. And that continued on when I went into school. It's interesting, we're in the Dominican Academy. I went to Our Lady of Guadalupe Elementary School, taught by Dominican nuns. And then I went, yes, oh, right.
We have some in the audience.
And then I went to Regis High School in Manhattan, which is a Jesuit school, which, interestingly, the theme of the Jesuits, both in high school and in college, I went to a Jesuit college, too, in Massachusetts, was it was an old boys' school, so it was men for others. So from the time I was riding my bicycle in the streets of Brooklyn to the time I graduated college, and I think it really relates back to my parents, I had this feeling that the natural thing to do was service. And that's really how all of this happened.
Well, we're lucky that you had that type of upbringing. What I was interested in, because my husband, Stu, also played basketball when he was younger, and you were a great athlete there at that time. And you loved all sports. And once you realized, well, I guess I'm not exactly cut out for sports, because you said you were too short to play basketball. I think what I want to know from you is, did you learn anything from those years when you were playing on these teams that you kept with you?
Well, yeah, I mean, the idea of as Barbara said, I was fascinated with sports, both baseball and basketball, and I was the captain of my varsity basketball team in high school. And there were two things about that were formative for me. One, the idea of teamwork and contributing, not just as an individual, but as part of a team, which was very important as we were challenged with a lot of public health issues later on. There's no one person that does it all. The other thing is that my basketball career allowed me to make sure that I was going into science, because in high school, I was a very good captain of the team, high-scoring point guard. And I thought I had aspirations that I was going to go into college and even, who knows, you know, maybe like Bob Cousy, be a professional basketball player. But I learned a very important lesson. I learned that a very fast, good-shooting, 5'7 point guard will always get destroyed by a very fast, good-shooting, 6'3 point guard. And that's when I decided I'm going into medicine.
All right. Well, God had that plan. So I have the last question on your youth before we get more into present day. When you were in high school, I was so taken by the amazing guidance you got from one of your Jesuit teachers, because you were torn, you said, between science and laboratory and all of that, and really interacting with people. So what I found fascinating is that the advice he gave you really stayed with you your whole life. Can you tell us about that?
The curriculum in Jesuit high schools then, and probably even to this day, was very heavily weighted towards the classics. So I took, you know, 4 years of Greek, 4 years of Latin, 2 years of a Romance language, and a bunch of other things that were very related to the humanities. And I was really struck by that, and I loved it. But when I got to the science, I really felt that I loved the discovery of science, and I was good at it. I had an aptitude towards it. And as Barbara said, I was struggling. I said, well, you know, I like science, but I don't really want to be a scientist. And I love people and being with people. And one of my teachers, a Jesuit scholastic, he wasn't even yet a priest, he was training to be a priest, told me, he says, you know, why don't you think about medicine? Because you can combine interactions with people, taking care of people, based on a scientific discipline. And it was like, I should have thought of that myself. But, yeah. But he just said it so clearly. He says, I think medicine would be what you really want to do. And it was the best choice that I ever made.
Well, we thank him. Right. We thank him very much.
Father McMahon. He was Mr. Yes. McMahon then, but now he's Father McMahon.
All right. Right. So in the 80s, at the NIH, you began your focus on a shocking new disease. We in the Bay Area, those of us of a certain age, will never forget it. And it was, as we all know, primarily affecting the gay community. And you made a very big decision, because you'd been at the NIH for a while then. You said you were going to put all your focus on HIV/AIDS. And some of your biggest friends and advocates said it was a career-ending move. Why did they say that, and why did you ignore their cautions?
Well, when I finished my medical training, which was medical school and a few years of medical internal medicine residency, then I took a fellowship in infectious disease and immunology, then I took another year of chief residence. So I had been trained for multiple years. But from 1972 to 1981, I had a very successful career, luckily for a very young person, mostly because I think I had a mentor who put me in the right direction of a project, and we had developed highly remission-inducing therapeutic regimens for diseases that were uncommon but deadly, autoimmune diseases, inflammatory diseases of the vessels called vasculitis. It was just another inflammatory autoimmune disease. And we developed such a highly effective therapy that I became very well known in the scientific community at a very young age, and my career was on a trajectory like this. Then in 1981, I was sitting in my desk right in the hospital where I worked on the NIH campus in Bethesda, and in June of 1981, an MMWR, which is called Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, which is a weekly report from the CDC about interesting new diseases that prop up. It could be a minor disease or a major disease. And there was a report of 5 curiously, otherwise previously healthy, young gay men from Los Angeles who presented with a pneumonia that only people who have very compromised immune system get. I actually have to admit in honesty, I thought it was a fluke, Barbara. I thought this is some drug that they took. You know, at that time, young gay men were taking poppers for increased sexual enhancement and satisfaction. I put it aside and thought it was nothing. 1 month later, in July of 1981, another MMWR landed on my desk. This time, 26, amazingly, all young, otherwise previously healthy gay men, not only from LA, but now from San Francisco and New York, who presented not only with pneumocystis, but Kaposi's sarcoma and other opportunistic infections. And what I did, I mean, I got actually goosebumps and hot flashes, like, oh my God, this is a brand new disease. When in medical history does anybody come into contact with a brand new disease? I mean, there were a lot of diseases we didn't understand very well, but they weren't brand new diseases. So I decided that I was going to put aside this trajectory of a really rising career, and because of a combination of the challenge of a new disease that very likely was an infection, we didn't know that, but epidemiologically, it was acting like a sexually transmitted disease, and it was destroying the immune system. And here I was, trained in infectious disease, trained in immunology. I said, my goodness, this is a disease that I'm meant and fated to study. The other thing was I had a tremendous amount of empathy for the young gay men who were suffering and dying and frightened about this bizarre disease. It didn't have a name. We were calling it gay-related immunodeficiency, which is a terrible name for a disease. It was very, you know, discriminatory. But it didn't have an etiology. So you could imagine how frightening that was to seeing all of these young men getting desperately ill and dying with a disease that you knew was an infection, but you didn't have any idea what that infection was. I just thought that was a challenge I could not walk away from. And that's when I just turned around the direction of my career.
Well, thank you for that. Yeah. I got to the House of Representatives in 1983. I say this because we didn't see each other, but I knew you were working on this thing. And I remember going for a walk with a best friend, and she was at that time a music teacher. She had written a book with a friend, a gay man, and we're taking a walk, and she says, "I don't know what's wrong with him. He's got this pneumonia." And of course, I think I'm a Jewish doctor because that comes with the territory. And I said, "Oh, that's nothing, pneumonia. He'll get penicillin, you know, he'll be fine." She said, "No, it's not that." And of course, then I get sworn in, and you already were 2 years trying to figure this thing out. I say that because when you called and asked me to do this, it was just sort of meant to be. It's my chance to say thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, a lot of dark days. We had a president who refused to say the word AIDS for a long time, and thank goodness there were other people around him that you worked so well with. But you write in such a beautiful way that the 80s, you call them very dark years for you.
Right.
And you tried to check your emotions, but you remember breaking down once after work, after you had seen your patients, you'd lost a patient. And you said you still have PTSD from AIDS. So Dr. Fauci, I want to ask you on behalf of everybody here, what got you through? What inside you got you through those dark days? And who did you lean on at that time?
Well, yeah, what got me through was the enormity of the suffering that my patients were having. You know, I went from this 9 years from 72 to 81, where patients had a disease that they thought they were gonna die from, and I developed therapies that gave them a 93% remission. And then overnight, I had a situation where all of my patients were dying, no matter what I did. It was like putting Band-Aids on hemorrhages. You would treat one opportunistic infection, and then another one would pop up. You treat that, and another one would pop up, and then ultimately, they would die. And it was years before we had adequate therapy, 1981, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And during those years, when you're taking care of patients, you develop relationship with them. And to see them all suffer and die, in order to be able to continue to effectively take care of them and be someone who cares for them at the same time as you're taking care of them, you couldn't let that personally get you down, because then you would reflect it on the patient, and that would be a bad thing. So what Barbara's getting to is that I had to suppress it. And when you suppress those kinds of things, it comes out later in life. And that's why many of us, many of my colleagues in San Francisco, who I just was with this afternoon, had a version of post-traumatic stress, where, you know, 25, 30 years later, you think about it and you actually, you know, well up with tears. And that still happens to me every once in a while. There was one patient in particular, and I wrote, you know, I wanted to give the reader a representation of the kind of thing that went on. There was one patient who I've been taking care of with my colleagues for a while, who had very advanced HIV. And one of the complications is a virus called cytomegalovirus, CMV, some of you may have heard of it, which actually can affect many organ systems, but particularly the eye. And it chews away at the retina and makes people lose their vision. And when you're in medicine, you're making rounds, and you make rounds in the morning and in the evening. And if the patient gets sick, you go in any time. You don't just do it in the morning, in the evening. And I kept on making rounds with this patient. And in the morning, I would come in, say hi to him in the evening, and he was gradually losing his vision. And whenever I would walk in the room, he'd always say, "Hi, Dr. Fauci, nice to see you, how you doing?" I'd come in the evening, "How you doing?" He was a very upbeat person for someone who had a very severe disease. And I remember one day, I just absolutely got crushed because I walked in the morning and I said, his name was Ron, I said, "Ron, how you doing?" He says, "Oh, good to see you, I'm doing fine. You know, my vision is getting a little bit more blurry, but I'm okay." That night, I walked in, went up to the bedside and looked at him, and I looked at him and he looked at me, and he didn't say, "Hello, Dr. Fauci, how you doing?" He said, "Who's there?" And it was clear that from the time I made rounds in the morning to the evening, he had lost completely his sight. And that was one of hundreds of patients who either had terrible outcomes like loss of vision and then death or just died. That was I describe it in the book, that was a dark period of my professional career, which only made, and I know you'll get to it, the development of life-saving drugs that completely suppress the virus such a great victory years later.
I'm getting to it.
I know you are.
I'm getting to it. But I think we have, sometimes we go, "Oh, isn't it great? We had this and you invented that and you cured it." What you went through, I think, is undervalued, and that's why I want to spend a minute on it. This to me was very interesting, your discussion of the AIDS activists. You recount how AIDS activists who disrupted norms and sometimes aimed their frustration at you truly made a difference. You didn't shun them, you could have easily done it. You took a different approach. Can you expand on that?
I will, but I forgot to answer the second part of your question. My wife was an AIDS nurse. And she was really amazing anchor and rock for me because she was experienced the same thing I was. So it was amazing. I don't think I could have done that without her. The AIDS activist. So that's a chapter in not only my book, but I think in history of one of the real amazing things that happened right here in our country is that in the early years of HIV, where this was a very unique disease, the scientific community, the medical community, had a way of doing things that was very regimented. You know, you have clinical trials and you have inclusion criteria and exclusion criteria. And in order to make the trial pristine, you couldn't get into the trial if you had this exclusion criteria. And then the regulatory to get a drug approved usually took years. And the activist was saying, "Wait a minute, once I get clinically ill, I have about 10 to 12 months to live. Do the math. Your system, although it works for other diseases, is not working for us. We want to sit down at the table with you and figure out how we can make the clinical trial and the regulatory process more suited to the very unique and terrible situation we're going through." Now, unfortunately, understandably, but now retrospectively, completely unacceptably, the scientific community was saying, "We're physicians, we know what's best for you, so just listen to us and do it our way and it'll be okay." The regulatory community was saying, "We have to worry about safety and efficacy, and we've got to do things slowly over a long period of time." So the activists said, well, you're not listening to us. So that's when they became provocative, iconoclastic, theatrical, and, you know, confrontative. The scientific community, when that happened, pulled back even more, which made it a big rift between them. So one of the best things I've ever done, Barbara, in my career, is that I was looking at what they were doing, and I was saying, for them to be so confrontative, they're angry, they're frightened, and they're dying. So I said to myself, let me put myself in their shoes. And when I put myself in their shoes, it became clear to me that what they were saying made absolutely perfect sense. And I would have done exactly what they were doing. What they were doing was making trouble. But as John Lewis said, it was good trouble.
Yeah.
And that's when I started listening to them. And when I did something that shocked them. And they even say to this day, they were shocked. Instead of, you know, saying, get them arrested for disrupting things, I said, why don't you come into my office and sit down and let's see if we can come to some sort of an agreement about how we can work together. It didn't happen overnight, and it took weeks and months and years to finally get us to really be working together. But at the end of the day, the system of clinical trials, the system of the relaxation and somewhat flexibility of the regulatory system was a very positive thing for medicine. So at the end of the day, the activists were absolutely correct.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh.
So to end the discussion on AIDS, I want to end it with the high note. With them pushing, you had been looking at vaccines. I don't really understand that part because I'm good with people, not good with science. Unlike you, you're good with people and with science. So can you explain why there never was this vaccine? Do you think there ever will be?
Yeah.
And how you worked with the private sector to develop the drug cocktails,
yeah,
which as I see it, was a lesson for all the other diseases that came along, including COVID, yeah, which we'll get, yeah, to next.
The development of drugs for HIV was a process that took place over years. It is, in my mind, you know, one of the great medical victories of the last, in memory, of our generations, because we went from a disease that was almost 100% fatal. In 1981, the first drug, AZT, was shown to be partially effective in 1986, approved by the FDA in 87. Then over the next few years, till 1996 was a watershed year, because in 1996, we at the NIH, in absolute collaboration with the pharmaceutical companies, they couldn't have done it without us, we could not have done it without them. And at that time, I was the director of the Institute, so I was directing those clinical trials that were going on. In 1996, the first triple combination of drugs for the first time brought the level of virus to below detectable level and kept it there below detectable level. And then in subsequent years, 97, 98, 99, 2000, we got better drugs, less toxic drugs, and instead of having 20 pills a day, we got down to one pill a day. And with one pill, you could drop the level of virus to below detectable such that we went from what was almost certainly a complete and inevitable death sentence to people who were living with HIV, if they took their medicines, could live, if you did the actuarial, they could live essentially a normal lifespan and maybe 1 or 2 years off. So if you were a young person with HIV and you were 25 years old, you could project that you'd live till you were 75, 76 years old, which was completely unheard of a few years earlier when everyone was dying. That was a major victory. With vaccines, Barbara, not so, because this virus is very unusual. When you make a vaccine for any pathogen, measles, polio, you know, rubella. Most of the people who get sick from that recover, and the body proves, as a proof of concept, that it's capable of making an immune response that can clear the virus. HIV is the only disease that we know that the body does not make an adequate immune response. So the paradigm of vaccine development going way back is develop a vaccine that mimics the virus without hurting the patient. Because we know when the patient gets infected with the virus, they ultimately make an immune response that clears the virus. With HIV, we had to do better than natural infection because we could not induce, no matter what we did, an immune response that was capable of protecting. Because once the virus came in, it just inserts itself into your cells and that's it, and you have it. It's sort of like a reservoir that's formed immediately. So the next question would be, do I believe we'll ever get a vaccine? And I think we can, but it would have to be by doing something that was never done before. It's by actually inducing and tricking the immune response into making a response that's even better than the response that you make against natural infection. And we're making progress in that regard, but I have to tell you, it's really a high bar, and it's going to take more years. Thank goodness, in the meantime, we have drugs that you can give in prevention, not only treating. So there's a thing called pre-exposure prophylaxis, which means that if you either give a single pill a day to someone who's uninfected, it's a 99% protection against infection. Wow. Now we have injectable that you can give twice a year and completely protect against it. So in some respects, although we're going to keep fighting for a vaccine, it's almost as if we don't really need, you know, a vaccine. If you can get someone who's willing to come in twice a year to the clinic, get an injection, and they're good for the rest of the 6 months.
Did you learn something from that?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I think the good doctor's going to give me a bill. I'm learning so much from this, Dr. Fauci. So now I'm getting more into current issues. You've made lasting friendships on both sides of the aisle. You served with 7 presidents, right? 4 Republicans, 3 Democrats. I served with 5. I thought that was enough. So congratulations on that. So you also had amazing relationship with staffs of every president until this last one, but more about that later.
The last one was okay.
Yeah.
The previous before
the
last
one. I know. Yeah. He caught me on a mistake because I am 6 weeks older than he is. And that's, let's face it, every minute counts.
I respect your age.
Thank you. Oh, that's wonderful. So, Dr. Fauci, your chapter on COVID is called A Disease Like No Other. And after all you've seen and you just talked about, AIDS, why do you say a disease like no other?
Well, if you just look at what the impact has been, we've lost 1.2 million people. That's the worst of any disease that we've had in the period of time since 100 years ago with pandemic influenza of 1918. It had some characteristics. You know, Barbara, for decades before, I was the director of the Institute for almost 40 years, as you mentioned in the introduction, from 1984 to when I stepped down in December of 2022. And during that period of time, people would always ask me, Tony, what keeps you up at night? What's your worst nightmare? And I consistently said, you know, go to YouTube and you know, check it out for 20 years ago, I consistently said a brand new disease that somehow evolves and jumps species from an animal reservoir the way flu did. Flu comes from birds and wild fowl. You know, HIV comes from chimpanzees. That's a respiratory-borne virus that is highly, highly transmissible, and that has a degree of morbidity and mortality that can have a major impact. And we've had respiratory diseases that have been important, but they haven't been cataclysmic. We had a pandemic in 1957 of flu, a pandemic in 1968 with flu, and we had a very mild pandemic in 2009, the famous swine flu that some of you remember. It was a pandemic, but the consequences with regard to morbidity and mortality, it spread a lot, but it didn't have the capability of killing. Well, my worst nightmare came true in January of 2020. And that's what I meant by a disease okay. like none other. Because at first we thought, because there was a lot of opaque information that was coming out from China in the first couple of weeks. Remember, in 2002, some of you may remember, we had SARS-1, which was a new coronavirus that evolved from an animal reservoir, from a bat to a civet cat to a human. There were about 8,000 infections and 784 deaths. But the one characteristic it didn't have is that it did not transmit regularly from person to person. The mortality was frighteningly high, about 10%, but it didn't spread well, so we were easily able to contain it by identification, isolation, contact tracing, and quarantine. When SARS came along, the second coronavirus, we thought it was some, or the Chinese were telling us it's like the first, and then as the weeks went by, it became clear that it spread phenomenally easily from person to person. And among vulnerable people, the elderly, those with underlying conditions, and even some young, otherwise healthy people, it was absolutely deadly. We had never seen anything like it before. We were having 4,000 to 5,000 deaths per day. We had never seen anything like that. That's what I meant by a disease like none other.
I got it. So you write about how President Trump was desperate for the pandemic to disappear. And he pushed a malaria drug, remember? Hydroxychloroquine, that he heard was recommended by Laura Ingraham on Fox News. This is all in your book.
Yeah.
All in his book. You write, that was when you realized that, this is such an understatement from my point of view, but it's what you said. You write, that was when you realized the Trump administration was different from all the... was different from all the Republican and Democratic administrations you had worked with. On top of that, you said, you never saw a president so hostile to the press. And you recounted a response to a reporter by President Trump after the reporter asked him, a very respected reporter, quote, he said to President Trump, what would you say to the Americans who are frightened by the pandemic? And Trump said, I would say you are a terrible reporter. And you write that you were concerned. You're so diplomatic. You write that you were so concerned that your presence would be, quote, interpreted by the press as acceptance of his behavior, unquote. So I guess my question to you, it's a tough one, but after that, did you consider leaving?
No, and I'll tell you why, Barbara.
Tell me.
Because it became clear that somebody needed to you know.
right. Okay. So when I put this question together, and by the way, my very first boss at the Pacific Sun who taught me to be a good interviewer is here, Steve McNamara. So he taught me. And so what I want you to know is when I put this together, I knew what an athlete you were, and I said, softball.
Yeah.
That's a softball. So you decided you had to stay because.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the beginning, and I tried to be fair, I had no antipathy towards President Trump at all. You know, I mean, he was an unusual character. We all know that. But I didn't do anything to feel like I wanted to undermine him. So in the beginning, in the first couple of months, probably, he accepted that this was, you know, a bad outbreak, but he kept on confusing it with flu, and he thought that it was going to come down and disappear
right.
in March and April. And he kept on saying things like, it's going to disappear like magic. And when it was clear it was not going to disappear like magic, then he started to invoke these magical cures like hydroxychloroquine. And it was only at that point, which quite frankly was very painful for me, I did not enjoy having to publicly contradict the President of the United States because I have a great deal of respect for the office of presidency. But when he started saying things that were clearly not true, I felt in order to preserve my own personal integrity, but more importantly, to fulfill my obligation to the American public, that I had to say, no, that's not true. And interestingly, he got less upset at that than his staff.
Yeah.
His staff got furious with me, and that's when they started to try and discredit me and undermine
right.
me, and that's
that
when
my next
all of the other stuff came on.
Right, so my next question is, we all remember the key role you played on TV, and you would come out, you would just speak to us and tell us what was happening and give us your latest thoughts, advice, the science, and all of a sudden, the press people took you off TV. You and Dr. Birx as well, you write.
Right.
You could only answer press questions, but suddenly you were off the air. And I think, I wonder myself, and so this is me speaking, do you think the president kind of didn't like the competition of you and Dr. Birx, and he kind of liked doing this himself? Or do you think the staff just said, Dr. Fauci is wrong? I mean, what do you think was behind all this?
Well, the communication staff at the White House went on something that was unprecedented. They did opposition research on me, which means they looked at everything I said and tried to contradict it. I mean, I was working in the White House, and they were actively trying to discredit what I was saying, which is really, you know, a little bit strange. The president didn't do that himself until very late as we got to the election. You know, there is a chapter in there that you know I call Love Me, Love Me Not. And what I meant by that is that he didn't seem to want to be in opposition to me. He would yell at me and say, why did you say this? You've got to be more positive. And after he would be screaming at me, then he would say, we're okay, aren't we, Anthony? You know? And I would say, okay, we're okay. it was only at the end when he really, you know, started the Fire Fauci thing. Yeah.
There's so much more, but here's Elaine. And so you promised you'd save me one more question.
I will.
Okay.
And I couldn't answer all 850 questions. I apologize, but we did pick four. So please talk, Dr. Fauci, about how medicine has changed and whether you encourage young people to go into medicine now.
Yeah, well, medicine as a discipline and science has changed for the very, very, very positive change in that the kinds of things that we can do now in medicine, now today in 2024, I would not have imagined when I was training in medical school in the 1960s and during my residency and fellowship in the late 60s and the early 70s, the medical advances have been absolutely breathtaking. We do have right now an anti-science theme in this country, which I think is reflective of the divisiveness in our society. That's a political divisiveness, which has spilled over into anti-science. So I would encourage a young person who's interested in going into medicine and science that the gratification and the fulfillment that you can get out of using the science of medicine to help people, to alleviate suffering, to prevent unnecessary and avoidable death is just priceless. And you know, many of us, and I've always felt that way, I would have done what I was doing when I was young, and even if they didn't pay me. Really, I meant that, and most of my colleagues felt that way.
You should be a bookseller. I love this next question. It starts out, choose this question. Dr. Fauci, I am a 17-year-old high schooler from San Diego, California. She came up all the way. Interested in studying medicine and public policy in the future. What advice would you have for someone interested in pursuing your career path? And P.S., I had a project at school where we had to choose a dream to do, and I chose to be you.
Well, my answer to the youngster who asked that question is very much similar to what I was saying just a little while ago about if not everybody should go into science. I mean, not everybody should be a physician, of course. But if you have the slightest inclination towards public health, she's interested in medicine and public policy, which is interesting,
right?
Because that's a very interesting interface between public policy and medicine. And I would encourage her to pursue that if she likes that, because that's where she can make things happen in medicine. And in fact, if she's listening.
She's here.
that's the reason why when I left the NIH and I took a position as a distinguished university professor at Georgetown University in Washington, I have a joint appointment in the Department of Medicine and in the McCourt School of Public Policy for that very reason, to try and bring together medicine and public policy.
Which you have so well done. And I'm going to put the next two questions together because I want Barbara to be able to ask her last question. But what public health resources would you like to see prioritized in the federal budget? And are we prepared for the next pandemic? And
well,
do you think you'll be consulted?
Yeah. So if you look at the preparedness and response to COVID, but also to HIV and other challenging outbreaks, there's the scientific preparedness and response and the public health preparedness and response. I would encourage the government now, I'm not in the government, but I still talk to them, you know, is to continue the support of basic and clinical research, because it was that which allowed us to develop these phenomenal drugs for HIV, as well as the vaccine for COVID. And by the way, Barbara Boxer was a very important component in getting us that money when she was a senator. So, the other thing that we need to improve a lot is our public health response, because we have a fractionation and a discordance between the local ability of a patient to get to a physician or to get into healthcare and the public health at the CDC and other level. We've got to strengthen the local public health, and we've got to give the CDC the capability of having a much stronger relationship with the local public health. In other countries, there's no space between the two. If you go into a clinic in the UK or in Israel, your history, your physical, your complaints go into a computer that's accessible in real time, at a level of public health. We have a big disconnect between public health and our individual care of a patient. We've got to fix that. The CDC knows that. So it isn't as if they know when they do an evaluation of how they can do better. They know that. And that's what I would recommend.
Thank you for that. That's really important for us to be thinking about. Senator Boxer, I think you have one more question
I have so many more. I have so many more, but I'm going to get it down to one. First, I want to say, before I ask the question, another thank you for coming out here to California to be with us.
Thank you.
California is a nation state, so as a nation, we love you, and you have to know that. The one thing I didn't get a chance to, you have to read the book, because there's this fabulous chapter when Dr. Fauci turns to this guy named Barney Graham, I remember?
Right.
And says, Barney,
he
says, Barney, we need a vaccine right away. And Barney said something like, get me the DNA of the virus, and we'll start working on it. Am I right in remembering
that? Yeah, he said, get me the sequence, and I'll start working on the vaccine in days.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so it happened. And so I also just want you to say thank you to your wife and kids for backing you through all this. And they've all gone. I mean, I know a teeny bit of what it's like, nothing like this, the sacrifices and some of the problems in this crazy world we live in. So send her our love too, and to the girls and to the family. So my last question, because when I read about the vaccine and all your team and how quickly it all happened, and you point out it was because of them and also the private sector, Pfizer, Moderna, et cetera. So I love to read the ending of books to find out really what you want us to know. And you wrote this, quote, we must sustain the critical investment in the biomedical and health sciences and continue to nurture collaborations between the public and the private sectors. So it's kind of like the last question, but more direct. Are you optimistic on those two fronts, that the investments will continue and the collaborations will continue?
Yes. As right now, as you know, the Congress is really wanting to cut down on NIH, which is really unprecedented, because for decades and decades, you know, while you were there and after you left, there's always been very strong bipartisan support for the National Institutes of Health. We absolutely have to maintain that support, Barbara, because the United States of America is overwhelmingly the lead in the world in biomedical research. I mean, you see that in drugs that are developed are United States scientists, United States companies. Nobel Prizes in medicine, it's like overwhelmingly the United States of America. That's not an accident. That is because we've had bipartisan support going back for decades and decades. So I'm optimistic because I believe that, you know, the better angels of people are gonna prevail and realize that this is the crown jewel of the federal government,
right.
And we cannot let that linger. And what you said, you made a very important statement, is that you have to have a public-private collaboration, because if you really want to get drugs and vaccines, the individual scientists, as brilliant as they are not going to get a new drug or a new vaccine. You have to have the ideas, the concept from the individual scientist, and partner with the pharmaceutical companies to actually make a product that would benefit the American public?
Well, we can only hope and pray that your vision is carried out. It's in our hands, is it not? It's in our hands, yeah. And, you know, you said in your book so many beautiful things, and when you said, you know, a disease like no other, this is a time like no other.
Yeah.
And Dr. Mm-hmm. Fauci, you deserve only the best honors, the love that you deserve to have from the public for what you have done in the face of daunting challenges. And we, again, are so thrilled to have you here. Thank you for writing the book.
Thank
Come
you.
Back soon.
Thank you.